Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Edward Moore Kennedy was 14 when his brother, John F. Kennedy, was elected to Congress, and the youngest of the nine Kennedy children started imagining his own political career.
The idea that you had a brother that was a congressman was just, I thought, was the biggest deal that could possibly ever happen to any family. And then when I'd go down and visit him, I'd come in for breakfast and I'd hear them talking about interesting things. And it was really the power of example.
A power that infused Kennedy's early years. He spoke often about the influence of his grandparents, including his mother's father, former Boston Mayor John Honey Fitz Fitzgerald.
I'll just give you one little grandpa story.
On vacations in Florida, Kennedy was assigned to drive his grandfather to a hotel in Palm Beach, where the teenager would watch the master politician at work.
I'd bring Grandpa down at 9 o'clock in the morning to the Breakers Hotel, and he'd go over and sit in the lobby with 12 newspapers. He'd go up to the concierge. He'd give the concierge $10 for the concierge to ring the bell once if the person was from Massachusetts and twice if they was from Boston. And just as I'd be ready to walk out, I'd hear ding, ding, and Grandpa would go up, "I'm Honey Fit from Boston. You must be from Boston, too."
Kennedy launched his own political career well before even close family members thought he was ready. But he persuaded his brother, the president, to help him win JFK's former U.S. Senate seat. Ted was elected in 1962. He was 30 years old. Kennedy was interested early on, as were his brothers, in issues rooted in their family experience.
All eight of my great-grandparents arrived in East Boston at the dock. I can look out my window in the JFK building in Boston. I could see the dock that they arrived at, every one of them not knowing what was going to happen. And they were fortunate, and we were able to participate in the democracy. It's a great gift.
Keeping the path to immigration open became one of Kennedy's signature issues. The first bill he managed in the Senate was the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965. His biographer, Adam Clymer, says it was one of several that Ted Kennedy took over after his brother Jack was assassinated.
That was a bill that Jack had drafted and hadn't gotten through the Congress. Jack had written a book called A Nation of Immigrants, and Ted carried that forward. He picked up a number of Robert's causes,
including work on Native American affairs and pressing to end the war in Vietnam. But early on, Kennedy adopted the issue that would become his passion.
There probably has not been a family in this country that has been touched by sickness, illness, and disease like my own family.
Before a national gathering of Democrats in 1978, Kennedy mentions his sister Rosemary's mental retardation, his father's need for constant care after he survived a stroke, the extraordinary cost of Kennedy's children's cancer treatment, and the 7 months he spent in the hospital healing a broken back.
We were able to get the very best in terms of health care because we were able to afford it. It would have bankrupted any average family in this nation.
Kennedy's first health care bill established federal funding for what was, in 1966, a new model for health care, community health centers. In 1969, 4 years after the creation of Medicaid and Medicare, Kennedy filed his first attempt at a national health program for all Americans. Stan Jones was Kennedy's first health policy aide.
Medicare was thought of as the first step. It was intended from the get-go that it eventually cover the whole country. Kennedy shouldered that mantle to finish the job.
Kennedy hoped to finish that job this year. For 40 years, he filed a bill to expand health coverage in almost every session of Congress. David Blumenthal was a longtime health care advisor.
He always saw himself as working toward universal coverage. He was willing to do children if that was the available opportunity. He was about getting real help to people, rather than standing on principle when the principle doesn't get real help to people.
So in the early 1980s, when it seemed clear to Kennedy that national health insurance was not politically viable, he began a series of what some former aides called incremental steps towards universal health care. He won passage of a plan to cover the unemployed. There were bills that preserved insurance when workers changed jobs, and a measure that expanded coverage for moderate-income children. This shift in strategy frustrated supporters of a national health program that would cover everyone. Harvard Medical School Professor Emeritus Rashi Fine, who helped draft some of Kennedy's national health bills, remembers a hearing on one of those incremental measures.
During the testimony, he turned to the audience and said, "There are those who would argue that a universal comprehensive system is really the best approach. And I would not deny that. But that's not where we are politically. And I will not hold hostage those people who can be helped today because I want to argue for something bigger and better, but which they can't have and which wouldn't help them now."
Kennedy adopted that pragmatic approach to the politics of the Senate as well as the issues.
Ted had a far-breathing, far-left liberal reputation that even about 20 Democrats didn't like and would almost automatically vote against him.
But Republican Senator Orrin Hatch says Kennedy, unlike some other liberals, adapted when Republicans took control of the Senate in 1980.
In the process, Ted has become, I think, the greatest liberal legislator in our land, and maybe one of the greatest of all time. And frankly, it's been a privilege to work with him. We are very close. We fight each other most of the time. I mean, we're like fighting brothers.
Hatch, despite pressure from Republican leaders, co-sponsored several health care bills with Kennedy, including SCHIP, a law that expanded coverage for moderate-income children. Kennedy balanced that pragmatic sense of how to get things done in the Senate with a role he cherished, as a champion of liberal causes and the Democratic Party. Former Press Secretary Scott Fersen remembers one afternoon in 1996 when his boss was working with Senator Bob Dole to pass a national parks bill while simultaneously working against Dole, the Republican presidential nominee.
Senator Kennedy had been on the floor for a very long period of time, red-faced, yelling about Senator Dole's lack of ability to be president of the United States. And yet, at the end of that, was able, as a colleague, to go over. And if it were somebody else, maybe Senator Dole would have had a different reaction than, "Oh, of course, Ted, let's go ahead and do this."
Former aides described Kennedy's three-stage approach to passing major bills. First, he would immerse himself in a subject with briefings from experts from all over the world. Rashi Fine remembers the first time he went to Kennedy's home in Virginia for an evening meeting on national health insurance.
And I said to myself, why in the world did I fly down? The senator is sitting there. He hasn't said a word. He's really basically asleep, although with his eyes open, which is kind of interesting. And then at about 10, he gathered himself up. And then for a half hour, 40 minutes, he was questioning things that we had said, probing deeper, and all of this without a piece of paper in front of him, without having taken any notes. I thought it was a tour de force.
Dozens of people who briefed Kennedy over the years described the intense listener who zeroed in on critical issues weeks or months after absorbing information. When Kennedy was satisfied with his grasp of an issue, he would map the politics, who in and outside Congress he could bring on as supporters and how. Then he designed a strategy for selling the idea to the press and the general public. His staff worked at a pace that exhausted many to keep up. Scott Fersen says most communicated with Kennedy through daily memos that he would read at home or on the road at night.
Every evening he would leave with what the staff would call the bag. It was called bag time. Mm-hmm. You had to make it. And it was interesting, you'd always say the bag would be leaving, not that the senator would be leaving, but the bag would be leaving at 7 o'clock if that was the case.
Fersen says the memos from as many as 100 staffers always came back the next day, marked up with questions or suggestions, no matter what Kennedy was doing that evening. And the evenings were often full. Tom Glenn, now the COO at Partners Healthcare, was deputy labor secretary in 1994 when he went to dinner one night at Kennedy's home to brief him on proposed welfare changes.
In the middle of the dinner and active discussion, he motioned to me to follow him. So I followed him down the hallway where he was getting ready to call Jerry Adams to tell him that the State Department had approved his visa, which was a very significant thing at that moment. And so while he's immersed in welfare reform, he's also working on an important international issue.
And sharing that moment when the then-controversial Sinn Féin leader learned he would be allowed into the U.S. with Glenn, who, like Kennedy, is Irish-American. For many who knew Kennedy, it's the personal touches they will remember.
Glenn cherishes the thank you notes the senator would send like clockwork after public and private events.
If you don't get a thank you note within 24 hours, it's because the mail system is broken. You know, I mean, he is just completely courteous with everyone. I have at home a stack of these notes that I've received, which someday, you know, my kids will have.
For special occasions, staff or acquaintances might get a print of one of Kennedy's paintings, of the compound in Hyannis, his sailboat, or daffodils, signed with a brief message. And staff say he loved to leave phone messages to stay in touch with constituents.
It's pretty amazing to have the mundane sorts of messages that are on the answering machine. Ken, this is Ted Kennedy. And there he is. It did mean a lot. It did mean a lot.
Ken Jones of Wenham met Ted Kennedy in 1989, shortly after his son Christopher was killed in the explosion of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Kennedy assigned a staff member to handle the personal and political ramifications and would call or send notes to family members to keep them up to date on the government's response to their concerns. Ken Jones says most of this work, including an initial hours-long meeting with families of Lockerbie victims, was done quietly, without fanfare, but had a deeply reassuring effect.
This legend, this Mount Rushmore kind of person, he took the time. It wasn't that he was looking at his watch, wondering when, off to the next meeting or whatever. He talked to us about his losses, and he shared his story with us, and we shared our stories with him. That was what was really important. Someone like Ted Kennedy caring at a time when caring mattered. Caring mattered.
I've been very lucky as an individual and honored to represent a state that has so many people that really care about their fellow human beings.
Many times over the years, Senator Kennedy echoed the same sentiments we just heard Ken Jones describe.
And this has been especially meaningful to me, to have that extraordinary opportunity to represent a state proud of its tradition and its heritage, and with people that do care so much about their fellow citizens. That has been extremely meaningful to me.
For WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.